Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is November 21, 1977, and this is my audio letter number 28. In the closing moments of audio letter number 22 for March 1977, I warned you that, quote, the elaborate war plan which I revealed in monthly audio letter number 6 for November 1975 is being revised and updated for application in the present circumstances. Certain of my sources have expressed great concern to me recently that a provocation for war in the Middle East is now being established that will be unlike anything we have ever seen before, unquote. And then I added, quote, to achieve that purpose, plans are being seriously considered, which, if carried out, could instantly throw all three major religions of the Western world into turmoil in the course of igniting a Middle East conflict. My hope is that by warning you of the existence of such plans, I am making them too dangerous for the conspirators to carry out. But in case they are carried out, I hope that you will now be able to recognize it immediately when it happens. End of quotation from audio letter number 22. As I speak these words today, 8 months later, the eyes of the world are suddenly focused on the Middle East as never before. The stalemate of Middle East peace negotiations has, in a week's time, been shattered in a spectacular way, and something unheard of is unfolding before our very eyes. After 29 years of hostility and wars, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt left Jerusalem today, where he talked of peace, face-to-face with Israeli leaders and to address the Israeli parliament. All other diplomatic efforts to bring peace in that region have been thrown aside by Sadat's unexpected mission to Israel. But already, Sadat finds himself almost totally isolated in the Arab world, supported only by Tunisia and Morocco. All this, my friends, is only the beginning. The plan to plunge the Middle East into war as the first step toward nuclear war one has now been set in motion, and Sadat's trip is intended to be nothing more than a major step towards fulfillment of this plan. It is now almost 2 months since America's disastrous defeat in the still-secret Battle of the Harvest Moon, history's first space battle on September 27, 1977. Since that time, our rulers have been trying for the very first time in their lives to deal with a situation in which they no longer have a hidden whip with which to make the Soviet Union cooperate with them. But they are not doing the one thing which would have at least a chance of preventing nuclear war, and that is total official worldwide exposure of the present Soviet war threat, as it affects not only the United States, but also many other countries. Instead, they are falling back on the techniques of maneuver, deception, and double-cross. Now that they have lost control of the Soviet Union, the Rockefeller brothers are discovering that their survival is tied to our national survival after all. But instead of letting us in on what we now face, their controlled CIA and other agents are trying to find some way to maneuver out of the Russian bear trap, stalling for time while still keeping us in the dark. My three topics for today are topic number one, a house divided against itself over salt. Topic number two, the exchange of Soviet and American threats. And topic number three, the Sadat trip to Israel and nuclear war one. Topic number one. In 1961, two major programs were started in parallel by the controlled government of the United States. One was America's crash program to go to the moon, announced by President Kennedy in May of that year. The other was a program to disarm America in stages, signaled by the creation of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in September of that same year, 1961. Neither the Moon Project nor the disarmament program was what it seemed on the surface. And while they were made to seem unrelated, they were actually two arms of a single military strategy for dictatorship over the United States and finally over the world. It is this diabolical strategy that has finally jumped the tracks, leaving not only the United States but also our hidden rulers in a desperate situation. The strategy which began to be implemented in 1961 was a very complex one, but its underlying concept is as simple as it is astonishing. Basically, our rulers were in effect going underground with all the most important new military developments while gradually stripping us of our existing, better-known military capabilities. In the process, our constitutional military services, that is, those which are required by law to serve you and me, have been gradually downgraded, weakened, and demoralized. But behind the scenes, unhampered by legal or moral constraints, ever more advanced weapons have been created for the exclusive benefit of our secret rulers, without any hint of their existence to the public or to Congress. Thus, as I first revealed 10 months ago in Audio Letter 20, the controlled CIA has secretly become the most powerful military agency in the United States, in total violation of its charter and the United States Constitution. The centerpiece of this 16-year-old program of developing totally secret weapons was our Moon program. In Audio Letter 26, 2 months ago, I told you the full story about our Moon Project, which from the start had a military purpose and which ended in disaster just 2 months ago on September 27, 1977. But there were many other aspects to this program as well. For example, in recent years, the American public have become accustomed to publicly acknowledged weapons programs, costing vast sums that seem out of all proportion to what the weapons are worth. These cost overruns, my friends, are due not only to mismanagement and waste, they are also a means of financing secret projects by burying their costs in the bloated budgets of publicly known programs. As for the weapons themselves that we are publicly told about today, it's almost as if innovation and progress had suddenly stopped in 1961, aside from marginal improvements here and there. When we hear about nuclear ballistic missile submarines, for example, how many people stop to think how long it has been since they made their appearance? The first atomic submarine, the USS Nautilus, was launched nearly a quarter century ago in 1954 and was a spectacular advance over the diesel and battery-powered boats of World War II. Only 5 years later, but now nearly 20 years ago, came the next spectacular advance, the ballistic missile submarine, beginning with the George Washington in 1959. At about the same time, the public was given a hint of things to come when films were made public showing the periscope of a research submarine outrunning a speeding Coast Guard cutter with ease. But starting in 1961, public attention to the possibilities of major future advances began to be avoided. In the same way, the 16 years from 1945 to 1961 saw spectacular steady advancement in military aircraft capabilities. In 1945, our first-line fighters and bombers were propeller-driven. Jets were still largely experimental, and most people took it for granted that there was a sound barrier that could not be cracked. But a mere 10 years later, jet bombers and fighters ruled the air, and supersonic travel was a reality. In 1956, the F-104 was introduced with a top speed of 2.5 times the speed of sound, roughly the same as the newest American fighters today. We hear all about the wonderful cruise missile, but we are not supposed to remember another kind of cruise missile of a decade ago, canceled by then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Called Pluto, it was to be nuclear-powered, able to circle the Earth several times over and strike an enemy from any direction at extremely low altitudes and supersonic speeds. And while we content ourselves with fatiguing 20-year-old slow B-52s, we're not supposed to remember that in the early 60s, the B-70 was already flying at 3 times the speed of sound. By now, most Americans have all but forgotten about these fast-moving developments of yesteryear. Many of these lie far beyond any technology which is publicly admitted to be in use today, and they provide a dim hint of the secret weapons developments that have actually taken place without our consent and not for our good. Only the most spectacular, huge program of them all, the Moon program, was made public simply because there was no other way to do it. As I explained in Audio Letter 26, secrecy was maintained by not letting us in on the purpose of the Moon program, bathing the program otherwise in great publicity. Originally, the plan was for the United States to be decimated in Nuclear War I as part of a larger plot for world control. But now, the secret American moon base in Copernicus Crater has been put out of action. The Russians are now on the moon, furiously at work. The Soviet Union is the exclusive possessor of the awesome new particle beam weapon, which is being used to blow our spy satellites out of the sky, and all but two of the secret CIA undersea super missiles, which were planted by Glomar Explorer and other means, have sprung leaks and become useless. For the very first time, the Soviet Union is in the driver's seat militarily, and America's secret rulers are in disarray over what to do. Last month, I exposed the events leading to the Carter administration's surrender to the Soviet Union on October 14, 1977, in the face of a deadly Soviet submarine threat against our country. The terms of this surrender require quick acceptance by us of a SALT II agreement, which will begin the final total disarming of America. But once we are disarmed, the intention of the Kremlin's leaders is to ultimately strike the United States in a devastating military blow anyway. The more fully we can be disarmed beforehand, the less suffering will have to be endured by Russia as the price of destroying America for all time. To grasp the Soviet thinking about all of this, one must begin by understanding one key but little known fact. The Kremlin is no longer ruled today by the Bolshevik communists, whose November 1917 revolution was celebrated this month. The Soviet inner circle today are communists, but of a very different breed from Lenin and his Bolsheviks. They were atheistic communists, whereas the ruling group today would be better described as self-styled spiritual communists. And while the Bolsheviks drew upon international support and were dominated by international interests, the Kremlin rulers of today are strongly nationalistic. They are determined that Soviet Russia, not just international communism for its own sake, shall rule the world. When Alexander Solzhenitsyn left the Soviet Union in exile, he first had to sign a document in which he indicated that he still believed in communism, meaning spiritual communism, in which the communist government would be under the control of the church. When he sent this letter to the Kremlin, it was accepted, and he was allowed to go. Solzhenitsyn today champions the reformation of the Soviet Marxist government, But this reformation is not intended to break down the present Soviet power structure. Indeed, Solzhenitsyn has said, while predicting the imminent fall of the West, that he expects to be back in Russia within just a few years' time. The takeover of the new ruling faction from the Bolsheviks began with the death of Joseph Stalin on March 5, 1953. This faction of Marxists working within Russia had allied themselves with the Bolsheviks in 1917, thereby guaranteeing the success of the Bolshevik Revolution. But even though the Bolsheviks and the self-styled spiritual communists agreed on the concept of communism as the proper form of government, the spiritual communists retained their separate identity and worked toward the day when they would be able to seize total control for themselves. That day arrived when Stalin died, March 5, 1953. The following day, Georgi Malenkov, the brother-in-law of Nikita Khrushchev, became Soviet premier. When he was succeeded 2 years later on February 8, 1955, by Nikolai Bulganin, the transition was peaceful, without bloodshed. A year later, Khrushchev, as first secretary of the Communist Party, launched his famous campaign to de-Stalinize Russia. Khrushchev himself had been an accessory to brutal purges on behalf of the Stalinist state, but when he replaced Bulganin as premier on March 27, 1958, the transition once again was peaceful. Bulganin had resigned. On October 15, 1964, Leonid Brezhnev replaced Khrushchev as first secretary of the Communist Party, and Alexei Kosygin became premier. Khrushchev was in deep trouble because of his failure in the Cuban Missile Crisis and some other sharp reversals of his policies. But even Khrushchev was not liquidated in the old Bolshevik tradition of bloody power struggles. Instead, he was simply pushed aside and allowed to live in quiet retirement, writing his memoirs and receiving his pension. Power struggles in the Kremlin for the past quarter century have been devoid of the bloody infighting that was typical of the Bolsheviks. The new breed in the Kremlin today can be as brutal as anyone with their enemies, or with those who rise up against their rule, as proven in Hungary in 1956 and in Czechoslovakia in 1968. But among themselves, there is a degree of tight-knit mutual respect that would have been inconceivable in the old Bolshevik days. They are united in their religion of spiritual communism and in their hatred for the international forces with whom they have been forced to cooperate for so long. My friends, the international forces which are controlled today by the four Rockefeller brothers is motivated primarily by greed and lust for power. But the self-styled spiritual communists who control the Kremlin today look upon their goal of communizing the world from an added perspective. While they strive for power and total control, they are motivated by the zeal of saving their own souls. Like the Christian crusaders of centuries ago, who sought to evangelize the world at the point of a sword, the Kremlin of today intends to impose its system on all of us with the dedication, steadfastness, and determination of the true believer. In their view, any amount of suffering and brutality is justified so long as it leads toward the final goal of world spiritual communism under Soviet domination. This change in the makeup of the Kremlin has never been fully understood or appreciated by those who dominate our government behind the scenes. And confronted as they are by the unified, determined stance of the Kremlin, they are responding with indecision, divisions within their own ranks, and desperate maneuverings. The real divisions that now exist within the ruling circles of this country are being compounded by some of these maneuvers, which are intended to stall for time without arousing Soviet suspicions. As a result, as the United States faces the worst threat in its history, we see in our own country a house divided against itself, some saying SALT II is wonderful, others saying it is dangerous, still others daring to tell the public a few words about the agreement that will seal our fate, yet others declaring in total ignorance that SALT II is a good thing and that its critics should be investigated. Some of the controversy is real, some manipulated, but most of the spokesmen on the political scene, regardless of their SALT viewpoint, are tied to the one Rockefeller International Party that rules not only North America but Europe and Japan as well, the Trilateral Commission, headed by one David Rockefeller. Last month, I described a growing euphoria over the certainty of a SALT II agreement. But even as I recorded that tape, the multi-pronged controversy over SALT II was increasing. On November the 1st, news reports suddenly said snags had cropped up in the SALT II talks. A former arms control negotiator was quoted as saying, "I believe we are locked into inferiority, and I don't know how to get out of it," unquote. The next day, November 2nd, Leonid Brezhnev proposed in a speech that all nuclear explosions be banned, including peaceful and underwater explosions. His mention of underwater explosions was actually a veiled threat, urging the Carter administration to get on with it in selling the SALT II surrender to Congress and the American public. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance immediately hailed Brezhnev's statement as a great thing, adding, quote, "There has been an improvement in the relationship between ourselves and the Soviet Union in the last several weeks," unquote. 2 days later, on November 4th, Vance was totally unprepared to back up his answers about SALT details in a closed-door Senate hearing. The reason is that the administration is preparing to go around Congress to conclude a SALT II agreement with Moscow by executive order. The SALT II contract will actually contain United States capitulation terms. Meanwhile, Congress is being used as much as possible to raise a smokescreen of controversy to provide an excuse to buy time. 3 days later, on November 7th, a fresh campaign began to reassure the Kremlin that the agreement of October 14 to accept the disarming of America by SALT II is still on track. Political attacks were unleashed against SALT critics for allegedly leaking information to the public that might jeopardize SALT II. Meanwhile, the 60th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution was being celebrated in Moscow with the biggest military parade through Red Square ever. And while Soviet President Brezhnev talked détente, his defense minister delivered a speech so belligerent that it left many Western observers shaken and bewildered. To continue soothing the Russian bear, Jimmy Carter said on November the 11th, quote, "My prediction is we will have a SALT agreement. There will be a SALT II. We will immediately continue with a SALT III," unquote. In this, he was parroting the Kremlin line, echoing Soviet Ambassador Dobrynin, who predicted that same day that there will be a SALT agreement before the end of the year. But the divided House of America's government continued to careen along out of control. Only 2 days after these reassuring public words to the Kremlin by Carter, officials of his own administration said that it would probably be another 3 to 6 months before SALT II became a reality. The same day, Senate Minority Leader Howard Baker told the press that SALT II, quote, "is in trouble now," unquote. Soviet exasperation has been building rapidly at the on-again, off-again political game playing over SALT II. Only last month, the Soviet Union backed off from a nuclear strike against the United States in response to a capitulation by the Carter administration on October 14th. The Russians can recognize Stalin when they see it, and they wasted no time in flexing their own military muscle this month to make the Carter administration knuckle under again.